just like you. Listener sponsored and commercially free. That's why we can have a program like Global Movement's Urban Struggles, Democracy Now!, The Morning Show, et al. But right now it's 10 a.m. Coming up next, Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. You know, sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree. Joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. I get more than my share, but that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you. Oh, 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 baby, I'm just human. Don't you know I have faults like anyone? Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. 'Cause I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.
Please don't let me be misunderstood. Gloria J. Brown Marshall here with you on Law of the Land. And we are continuing our discussion of civil rights then and now. And it's important. And some people may think, oh, it's not progressive enough. Well, you know, Sankofa says, you have to know your history to understand where you are and then plan for where you're going. We need to know that we have done so much in the social change civil rights community. Do you understand that a minority of people, a minority within the minority, changed a superpower? Do you really get that? And I know you're not told about it, because who among so many of the majority would tell you just how powerful you are? That people in Syria right now are using bombs and weapons and guerrilla warfare to do what we did through nonviolence in a country that will kill you. I think we have to make that clear. Over 5,000 people were lynched, some of whom burned alive in this country. They're not playing when it comes to power, when it comes to the vote. So that's why we continue to stress the need for you to have a role in your government by voting. If your vote didn't count, they wouldn't try to kill you to take it away from you. It wouldn't be grandfather clause cases and literacy tests and all of these, how many jelly beans in the jar, and if you don't get the number right, you can't register to vote. Poll taxes, we had to change the Constitution of the United States and have an amendment, a 24th Amendment to the Constitution. Go to your Constitution, or you could go to mine, the U.S. Constitution in African-American context. Either way, you'll see the 24th Amendment repealed all poll taxes in federal elections. We had to have an amendment. You know how difficult it is? We only have 27 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. And we had to amend the Constitution in order to get rid of poll taxes. We had literacy tests. People had to take a test on the Constitution in order to just register to vote. People are dying right now around the world trying to get what we fought for here in this country and then take for granted. As we go into this 2016 election cycle, and it's coming close, we're in November, this next year is going to be something. We're watching it already unfold. And you need to make sure that you are registered to vote, that you register your family to vote, that you check to see. I checked to see if my registration was still, my registration was not there. When I voted, my name was not listed. My name was not listed in the place I voted every year since I've lived there, all, you know, over 10, 12 years. So I had to go through this whole process of telling them again and registering again and making sure that I voted absentee ballot, which, of course, might not have gotten counted. But I'm glad I found out this election cycle as opposed to the next one. You have to check on these things. There are sometimes things are going on in this country. For those of you who have been here for less than a minute, sometimes there are things going on in this country that undermine the sense of democracy that we are. So we need to understand, in order for this great democracy to be great, this practice, this great experiment called America, we have to keep pushing. You don't sit down and let somebody else drive the bus. You keep pushing, and that's what this show is about. Law of the Land is about empowering you through an examination of the law, different perspectives on the law, and especially civil rights law. You know I have a civil rights background. And you know there have been so many people who have given their lives and livelihoods to allow us to even be on the air right now. This is so important to the making of a democracy, the maintaining of one. And I dedicate this particular program to my Aunt Ruth, Aunt Ruth Gordon Bradshaw, who passed away a week or so ago. And it's so important that people know that she existed as a fierce black woman, a doctor in psychology. And she started off in nursing, a graduate of Tuskegee University. She was a fierce, fierce intellectual. She was the one who actually, on her missions to the prison in Alabama where she lived and where I was working at the time, she actually would counsel the women in the segregated HIV unit. Yes, in certain parts of the country, people with HIV were segregated from the rest of the general population of the prison, and that's what took place in this women's prison in Alabama. And after several class action lawsuits, and she presented evidence for some of those lawsuits, they finally improved the conditions in those prisons. I'm going to do a prison show soon, and that prison show will be dedicated to Eddie Ellis, who was a friend of mine and did so much around these issues. There's so many people who have done so much to make this country a better place, to make it better than it would be had they not given their contributions. And this particular show, Law of the Land, we're going to focus on civil rights strategies. As you know, my background is civil rights. I teach at John Jay College, and I teach constitutional law, race and the law. I explore these strategies in my book, Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to Present. I explore them through the prism of law and education, voting rights, civil liberties like protest. We've talked about all of these different things. We're going to talk more about criminal justice. As you know, John Jay College has a criminal justice conference. It's a year-long conference bridging the divide between police and the community that is going on. You really need to participate. And in order to have a bridging of divide between police and the community, we need the community that's you. So I thank those BAI listeners who did attend the programs. I had some time to spend with you. I'm glad I had a chance to meet you. And I'm glad you're listening. Thank you so much for your support of this program, your support of WBAI. So as we continue to work toward a better democracy, making this a better place in which to live, I want you to know our civil rights program today, Civil Rights Strategies Then and Now, focuses on what it was that we did as a community to accomplish the goals that would give us the Voting Rights Act. This year, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. What was going on? What strategies did we have in mind? What was the mindset? And then again, we're going to go to what was the cost, the emotional cost of it? We have a very exciting show for you today. The program, as I said, is going to focus on civil rights strategies then and now and the cost. And our guest coming up will be Dr. Thomas Bynum, a professor, and he will be discussing his book during Gloria's book list, and that is at 10:30. And he is going to be talking about the youth in the NAACP. Sometimes we look at the NAACP today and we go, I don't know if it's connected with the young movement of Black Lives Matter, et cetera. But we're going to talk about there was a time when it was. But we also have a very, very special guest with us today. So unique. And that is for our discussion around civil rights then, the Honorable Andrew Young. Yes, the Andrew Young, the Ambassador Andrew Young, the Mayor of Atlanta Andrew Young. Yes, that's the Andrew Young we will have on this program at 11 o'clock, who will be able to guide us and tell us, the person who worked with Martin Luther King. Yes, that Andrew Young. Yes, we need to understand from those who can give us insights on civil rights then and now to better understand the strategies we need to go forward. Because right now we're in a difficult place. We can see the onslaught of those who are attempting to take our rights or limit our rights, but we don't feel the need, the power to come together and work. So we're going to discuss all of those things, and we're going to have a psychologist on the program at the end to talk to us about what do we do with all these feelings that we have when we feel that we're the object of discrimination and we want to do our best, but we have all these things coming at us. That is a power-packed program, and you're getting it here on Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall and WBAI 99.5 FM.
This march, and I'm saying that this is an unlawful assembly. You have to disperse. You are ordered to disperse. Go home or go to your church. This march will not continue. Is that clear to you? I've got nothing further to say to you.
I could remember was outburst of tear gas, and I saw people being beaten, and I began to just try to run home as fast as I could. And as I began to run home, I saw horses behind me, and I will never forget, a freedom fighter picked me up Hosea Williams. And I told him to put me down. He wasn't running fast enough. And I ran and I ran and I ran.
We were about two blocks away from the bridge, and we went back to try to help people back. But the police were riding along on horseback beating people. And the tear gas was so thick you couldn't get to where people were in need of help.
And that was Andy Young speaking. I want to let you understand, help you to understand. Hundreds of people were beaten by Alabama state troopers on that bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama, as they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in a peaceful protest to gain their right to vote. This is the sacrifice. This is the story. It's a very American story. As American as the colonists who fought Great Britain, as American as any American story is the one of African Americans and other people of color fighting for their right to vote. Once again, another excerpt from our upcoming guest, Andy Young.
There were people who came back to the church and started talking about going to get their guns. You had to talk them down. And you had to talk them down by simply asking questions. What kind of gun you got? 32, 38. How's that going to hold up against the automatic rifles and 10-gauge shotguns that they've got? And how many you got? There are at least 200, you know, shotguns out there with buckshot in them. You ever see buckshot? You ever see what buckshot does to a deer? You know, and most of them had. And you make people think about the specifics of violence, and then they realize how suicidal and nonsensical it is.
Andy Young speaking about that Edmund Pettus Bridge Bloody Sunday 50 years ago this past March. As you know, I was in the Selma 50th commemoration crowd covering that story for you on BAI, letting you know up to the date. There was, of course, Representative John Lewis, who was then a college student. So the young people who have a chance to hear this show, who are listening and trying to fathom, what is this issue of race? I have a best friend who's of another race. I don't understand. In my classes, I speak with people who are Asian American or Latina or Latino, and everyone's looking at it from an individual standpoint. What happened to my life individually? This country has in its fabric an issue of race discrimination in the fabric of the country. Other countries may have in their fabric religious discrimination or economic discrimination. It all depends, but this is ours. And just like any chronic illness, that if you don't take care of the host will become impaired. If we don't make sure we press on to heal the wound, this deep wound, it will become infected, and you will have incidents like that at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, like that in Ferguson, Missouri, that we witnessed last year. As people fight a system to gain the rights that they've been promised through the U.S. Constitution. That's what makes this such a conflict, such an irony, that we have this document called the U.S. Constitution that we export around the world. And few people, regretfully, in this country have even read it or understood it or realized the power of the document in their individual lives. And collectively, we need to understand as communities, any way you want to spell community, the LGBT community, which has now taken on a force of its own in civil rights, on the foundation laid by those people of color, in particular African Americans, in constitutional law. All of these communities, whether or not it's the immigrant community or whatever community, African-American community, women's community, the community then goes forward and says, you promised me these things within the U.S. Constitution, and because you promised me these things, I ask, no, I demand them, because the First Amendment says in its last phrase, that clause, to petition the government for redress of grievances. And that is what communities demand, to have the government redress the grievances of harms based on the failure to gain the constitutional rights that have been promised. Martin Luther King said that the U.S. Constitution is a promissory note, a promissory note. And so this particular show, Civil Rights Strategies Then and Now, Civil Disobedience, which is the protesting and perhaps breaking of a law for just reasons that are considered unjust laws. The sit-ins, for example, were protests with civil disobedience. Mahatma Gandhi actually was in Byron Rustin, were the major figures when it comes to civil disobedience, and the fact that we have people who are protesting for the rights that are in the Constitution. And in many instances within the civil rights movement, as Martin Luther King says, we're protesting for the right to protest. Protesting for the right to protest. But what were the strategies behind this? Some of those strategies involved trying very, in a particular way, I'm trying to fight a government that is using guns and underhanded tactics or straightforward police violence, as in the Edmund Pettus Bridge incident. Fighting them with nonviolence, trying to develop what was a strategy at that time and a national movement around nonviolence. And as the Honorable Andrew Young said, and he said it back 50 years ago, what is violence going to do against violence? Is it going to be guerrilla warfare that we end up in? Are we going to be another Syria? Is the country going to say enough is enough? We're not going to continue to have our image, you know, debased around the world based on our own actions. Those strategies, all those different strategies, each play a role in the progress for civil rights. So as we go forward in this particular program, we have a professor who is discussing in his book, NAACP Youth and the Fight for Black Freedom, 1936 to 1965. And he's going to discuss the use of youth. Now, this is going to be very interesting from the standpoint of how do we access young people? This has been a really important issue today, but it wasn't an issue just for today. And this is what we need to understand. That's what Sankofa is about. How do we understand what we're dealing with today if we don't look at the history? And the history is that young people have played a pivotal role in social change. They always have. And when you look at the Martin Luther King-led protests, for example, the Montgomery bus boycott and other types of protests, we'll find that there were young people involved in those protests. When we look at the SNCC program, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and their protests, their strategies, these are college students. Where are our college students today? Our college students today are in need of a role in social change. And we need to understand the strategy that would involve them and what role they would play. And I think it's important as adults or older adults with experience to gain more information about the civil rights movement, the role young people have played. If you think about how young John Lewis was when he stood on the front line crossing that Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965, he was in his early 20s, and here he is, a leader of a movement. Why aren't we allowing our young people to take these leadership roles? Why aren't the young people preparing themselves for the leadership roles? And if they are, how do they and older people work together for a common cause? These are the questions I think about. These are the issues of concern to me. With a background in civil rights, looking at the Constitution, trying to figure out where we're going, what is the plan? And I ask this on a regular basis. What is the plan? How do we go forward? What's the vision? Because without vision, the people perish. And we need to know the vision. And I have a vision in mind, but I need to make sure that it's not just an individual vision. We didn't get here through an individual's vision and power. We got here through a collective movement that doesn't necessarily have to have a particular person leading it, but it has to be one vision that we can all participate in under different umbrellas. Perhaps that's what needs to happen. I'm not sure, and that's what I'm trying to work out in this particular program, and you're working it out with me. I want you to have these discussions among your own friends. I want you to have these discussions with your family members. We have to talk about this. We just can't assume somebody else is going to take the lead and make it happen. So in this particular program, Law of the Land, with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, we're going to look at the legal issues. We're going to look at the constitutional law strategies as well as the protest strategies that allowed us to go forward in civil rights then and now. And our first guest, I'm very pleased to say, is a professor. And this professor, this particular professor, is one at Middle Tennessee State University who has written a very interesting book during this segment of Gloria's book list that's part of Law of the Land. And the book is The NAACP Youth and the Fight for Black Freedom, 1936 to 1965. Professor Thomas L. Bynum, help me, help us better understand how the youth played a role in our civil rights collective action during the early time period, and perhaps we could kind of find out or figure out what role they can play today that fits into what we already know historically they can do. Is that too much for me to ask? And welcome. I've already given you work, and you haven't said a word.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show. I write about the NAACP youth movement in the 1930s under the leadership of Juanita Jackson. Mitchell, Juanita Jackson, believed that the young people should get involved in protests during this time period, and she also believed that the NAACP should harness the energy of young people to fight for racial equality. And so I talk about it in the book, and I talk about how they were involved in direct action campaigns, such as anti-lynching demonstrations. They were also involved in boycotts, boycotting businesses where, you know, black people were discriminated against. They had what we call don't buy where you can't work campaigns. Also, I talk about the sit-in demonstrations that happened well before the sit-in of the 1960s.
So This is really fascinating. So the sit-in movement did not start in North Carolina in the 1960s?
No. One of the earliest sit-ins that's documented in history was carried out by the Howard University chapter of the NAACP in 1941. Students at the university could not eat at restaurants around the school. And so these young people basically were determined to desegregate those restaurants around Howard University.
And that movement lasted for how long? How long did they have their sit-ins there? And was it successful?
Yeah, the sit-ins were successful. So they carried out that sit-in during the semester, and they were successful in getting those businesses to desegregate the restaurants. And we see other sit-ins occurring, you know, again, before the 1960s. There are sit-ins in Oklahoma where you have young people associated with the Oklahoma Youth Council staging sit-ins at restaurants and other businesses that discriminated against blacks. You also have it in Wichita, Kansas. And so these sit-ins predate the sit-ins that take place in 1960s, but what they do is prepare young people to engage on a larger scale in the 1960s in protest demonstrations.
So the NAACP founded in 1909 and moving forward as a small group of mostly white liberals
and W.B. Du Bois and a few others, decides very early on that the role of young people should be an important one.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they understood if the organization was going to sustain itself, right, if the organization was going to live on and have a legacy, that they had to harness the power of or the energy of young people. That's important. If you think about it, young people don't have the economic obligations that older people have. They don't have families to provide for. And so they can take the kinds of risks that older people cannot.
And we saw this during the Montgomery bus boycott, and it was a major issue of contention between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, if I'm correct, and the use of the young people by the civil rights nonviolent movement. And we're talking about high school students, because as you pointed out, high school students didn't have to worry about their jobs. They didn't have to worry about if they lost a job that the whole family wouldn't eat and or be dispossessed of their homes. And so these young people, and we're talking about middle school and high school students, were very active in the nonviolent civil rights protest movement. And so this issue about the use of young people, the role they should play, the conflict, mm-hmm. if you're familiar with, between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King was that I think Malcolm X chided Martin Luther King for saying, yeah, you're using these young people. They don't know what they're doing. What is it that you feel? On the one hand, we say you have to be 18 or over to actually have a mind that's, you know, fully developed to understand the mm-hmm. full consequences of your actions. But at the same time, they're saying we want to use you physically and be a part of this movement. So did they have a real role, or were they just being used as fodder in this protest?
No, I think young people had a real role. And you know, young people, and I think it's hard for some people to wrap their minds around this, that young people were political actors. They were agents for change. Young people played a crucial role in many of the major demonstrations, and we definitely see the role of young people in the Birmingham demonstration in 1963, the Children's Crusade. And here you have young people participating in this movement. They brought about significant change in that city, in Birmingham, one of the most segregated cities in America. And these young people were on the front lines. They were jailed. And as they jailed these young people, more youth would come and participate in the demonstrations. And they realized, and what Martin Luther King realized, if they fill up the jails, they got to release people. And these young people would go right back out and continue to protest. So I would say young people played a very important role in these demonstrations, and they were not pawns, but they were agents for change.
And in your book, NAACP Youth and the Fight for Black Freedom, 1936 to 1965, and of course, if you're on Gloria's book list, I have read your book. And I try to pride myself in that. And going through, we actually have a Brooklynite, Virginia E. Anderson, in your book. And this is the Second World Youth Congress. I mean, this is amazing today to think that there was this World Youth Congress. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so you have young people gathered together, and they would have these conferences where they would talk about what change that needs to happen in the world. And so they were linking, African-American youth were linking their fight against Jim Crow segregation with broader forms of discrimination like colonialism, right? And so these young people were well aware that racism was not an American dilemma or disease, but it was a worldwide disease. And they had to unite together to fight against those forces. And so you definitely have the World Youth Congresses happening on several occasions where these young people are coming together to discuss very important issues.
And so when you made your argument before that these were not you know, young people used as cannon fodder, that they had an intellectual role in the strategies going forward.
Absolutely.
And that's very important to understand. It takes a mature mind to think not just of my daily needs or wants and desires, but where are we going as a collective, and how does this collective fit into an overarching vision of discrimination in the world?
Absolutely. It was Ella Baker in 1960, when you have the formation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She said to the young people, she said that you should not allow the adults to control your organization. She wanted the young people to basically be free of adult influences. And she realized that you can't have a charismatic leader. Her concern was, you know, everyone should be educated. If you educate the group, then you can move out, right, into the community and do the work that's required. And so she called for group-centered, you know, activism. And we see a lot of that today with young people. The movement that we are looking at today seems to be a little more organic, grassroots, and you don't have a charismatic leader. And that's a good thing. This is not to discount what happened in the past. We've made huge accomplishments in the past, but I think for today's society, we need that kind of group-centered leadership, and it needs to be a little more organic, because although you have commonalities when it comes to racial oppression, but they vary from location to location.
And what is meant by charismatic leader? I know we hear that phrase a great deal, but when you use it, how do you mean it?
I mean it in the sense that you have this leader who's able to basically stir up the crowd. Like Martin Luther King was a charismatic leader. He was able to come in and stir up the crowd, right, to galvanize that kind of, you know, support behind the movement. But at the same time, Martin Luther King couldn't be in all places, right, at one time. And so we need people to move out and do that kind of work. Independent of a charismatic leader.
But we also know that Martin Luther King had many meetings, multiple meetings around strategy. It wasn't just, I'm going to go out and get the crowd riled up and then go home. There was a purpose for riling up that crowd, a purpose for getting them to better understand the role they could take within the collective to move the position of social justice forward. And so I would say, yes, we don't have to have that charismatic leader if all they're going to bring is charisma, if you're not going to bring a plan and a vision. You know, and I think one of the things that we're struggling with right now is, what is that vision and what are the strategies to get us there? And that's why we're so glad to have you having a part of this discussion as someone who is an associate professor of African-American history at Middle Tennessee State University, someone who has written this wonderful book, NAACP Youth and the Fight for Black Freedom, 1936 to 1965, who can give us insights on where we are now as compared to what happened then. Did we have a lull during that time period in the early part of American history in which something had to spark action in order for us to better understand how youth could be a vital part of this, or did the NAACP always envision using youth?
I think the organization had always envisioned using young people, but certainly did not recognize or did not even realize the magnitude of their support, their energy, and what young people could do. As I said earlier, they didn't see young people. Some of the older members within the organization did not see young people as political actors, but young people are very savvy. And even today, when we look out and see the different protests around the country in terms of Black Lives Matter, we see that these young people are educated around the issues. They are not just staging demonstrations without the intelligence or without the knowledge, but they are well aware of what's happening in terms of police brutality. Police brutality is not something that happened in the 21st century. Black people have always dealt with police brutality. We can see it with all of the major demonstrations where young people participated in, that they were attacked by the police. And these are peaceful demonstrators. So I think what we're experiencing today is a reflection of things that have happened in the past.
And the strategies then, and how youth would be used. We talked about the fact that they could have youth be a part of a protest that would allow them to fill up the jails, them to actually protest in the streets without undermining the economic stability of the entire family. So if the parents were to be a part of this protest and the parents were arrested or beaten or hospitalized or in prison, that means the whole family's economic viability has been undermined. So having that young person take that role and be able to put that young person forward. And also when you have young people, you have creativity. And I'm a creative person.
Absolutely.
And sometimes within the civil rights movement, even whether or not it was 15 years ago or today, you have the same people in this little capsule thinking of the same ideas without having anything creative, no new air come into the room to actually get the senses going of a what if. And I think young people bring that what if. And you and I both teach college, and we know there are many times when that question or answer comes out of a college student's mouth and you wonder, where did that come from? But young people come up with some really different ideas.
Absolutely.
And and to realize, as we said before, how young Martin Luther King was. He was 39 when he was assassinated. 39.
Absolutely.
So how young he was when he led the Montgomery bus boycott. How young John Lewis was when he walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. That we're not giving our young people an opportunity. But then I have this question for you. Are they reaching out for the opportunity, or are they sitting back, letting older people and other generations do all the work?
I think looking back and looking at the challenges that the older generation faced in terms of Jim Crow segregation, you had blatant forms of racism, right? So it's kind of in your face forms of racism. But today, we're dealing more with systemic forms of racism, institutional practices. And I think young people tend to think of racism as an individual act of discrimination, being called the N-word. But I don't think they think much about these institutional practices, systematic forms of racism. And I think this is where you and I play a very important role, because we're educating young people about the institutional racism that exists on a day-to-day basis and how they can deal with that when they're confronted with those issues. And so I think young people need to be educated around these issues that we are dealing with today, such as police brutality and how to handle those issues in an effective way. And I think once we go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, when you say that, it's, sometimes it's this question like, this is new. And to understand just how long this has been going on. And when I say this, I mean those people within the majority community who have decided that you need to stay in your place and your place is not up here with me. And so therefore, the law is going to be used as well as social oppression to maintain a certain strata in which people of color or immigrants or whomever that group may be is going to be marginalized. And the youth within that group, and this is what's so interesting, because if young people really get it, then they understand that not only are you young, but you're young within a marginalized group. And so then you have even more of an incentive to step up and take your role in creating a better future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Racism is a permanent disease, but we have to understand how it has transformed itself over time. And once we start to understand the changing nature of racism, how does racism rear its ugly head in the 21st century? Once we start to move out in that direction and explain that to young people, I think we can have a more effective movement among young people.
And we're talking today about Black Lives Matter, and people have criticized Black Lives Matter. They've had some dissension within their group, but this is normal. This is what we need to understand, that all of this is normal. You know, it's normal to have dissension. It's normal to have conflict within these groups as people move forward and to undermine and criticize Black Lives Matter because, oh, they're young and they're radical. What is radical? What does it mean? We're living in a time of such provincialism. I mean, I'm amazed at how conservative this country is right now. And I ask once again, where are the progressive whites? Where are they? We know our WBI listeners are progressive whites, but then where are their extended family members? Where do you fall in this? I mean, this is how we could have so many horrific things happen with lynchings and with discrimination and homes burned and cattle killed and people pushed off of their land. All these things can happen, as Martin Luther King said, when good people do nothing. And so we have, when we talk about the African-American experience, we also know, as Lonnie Guinier, professor at Harvard, said that, you know, African-Americans are the canary in the coal mine. If it happens to us first, it'll happen to you next. So understanding even mass incarceration and how now mass incarceration is affecting more than just communities of color. Now it's like, oh, we need to do something about that. Well, you could have been doing something about that about 20 years ago, at least. But going back to young people, and this, even the movement around mass incarceration, do you think that sometimes young people see these institutionalized issues and think they're too big for me to participate, to do anything, to make any change?
Perhaps so. But what we can do on local level and eventually branch out to the state and national level is to start to educate young people around these issues, such as police brutality, how to deal with the police when they come in contact with the police. NAACP started workshops on training young people how to interact with the police. We might see that as insignificant, but it's very important. And so that they don't become belligerent when they feel like they're being racially profiled. There are strategies, there are ways that we can get young people educated around these issues, and I think workshops are a good way to educate young people about some of these issues, especially police brutality, since we're seeing it happening more and more within our community. And the mass incarceration of young Black men, we really have to get at what's happening in our communities. And one of the things I've said, and I've said this over and over, it's because Black communities are overly policed, right? So you have the police in Black communities because Black communities have been, for a long time, especially inner city communities, have been associated with criminality. And so you have the police in those communities, over-policing those communities. And as a result, we see, you know, the mass incarceration to some extent of some young people.
And there's a recent, I believe it was a New York Times article, on wanting a gentler consequence to heroin addiction. And this is amazing, because now that more white, young whites are becoming heroin addicts, are caught selling heroin, now we want a gentler consequence to the addiction and to the criminal, to the criminal sentencing. And that is, once again, the canary in the coal mine. So when there were drugs in the community, and please, I really have to say this about marijuana and the fact that marijuana now is seen as this drug, this recreational drug. And I can only imagine in Colorado and other places where you have young Blacks and Latinos who are incarcerated for selling marijuana. And you have people in their limousines who now have businesses selling marijuana driving by the prisons. This is the most ironic thing in the world. And once again, you see how the law can be used and abused depending on the group, you know, the group that is the object of the focus. But and this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm speaking with Professor Thomas Bynum, who's an associate professor of African American history at Middle Tennessee State University. His book, NAACP Youth and the Fight for Black Freedom, 1936 to 1965. Fascinating book. I have been doing a great deal of research lately around the NAACP and its legal cases. And one of the other, I think, unsung heroes of the youth movement is Claudette Colvin, who is actually, I've been told, in the New York City area, and I hopefully will be able to contact her at some point. So if someone knows Claudette Colvin, where she is, please ask her to come on the program, because I really want to talk with her about her movement in Gale versus Browder, the U.S. Supreme Court case that was parallel to the Montgomery bus boycott. And that Montgomery bus boycott that went on for over a year, a little over a year, and people think that alone ended the discrimination, the segregation of the public buses in Montgomery, but actually it was the case of Gale versus Browder, the U.S. Supreme Court case in which we had these four young people who decided, and especially Claudette Colvin, who was the youngest, that they would not give up their seats. This was before Rosa Parks. So you had these young people, these young girls, high school girls, who decided that she said, and it's been noted, as she was dragged from the bus because she wouldn't give up her seat and arrested, I have constitutional rights. So here we have this 15-year-old who understood her constitutional rights, had that mature mind, stood her ground, and even before Rosa Parks was a leader among young people in the NAACP movement of trying to oppose the laws that segregated her on these buses. And your book is filled with so many of these different stories of young people, and especially around voting rights. Tell me, if you can, about the young people and their role in working for voter registration and voting rights.
Yeah, and I want to go back to the Claudette Colvin piece, because Claudette Colvin, as you pointed out, refused to give up her seat on the bus long before the Rosa Parks incident. But Claudette Colvin was a member of the Montgomery NAACP youth chapter, and Rosa Parks was the advisor for that chapter. And so Rosa Parks had been instrumental in educating young people about racial oppression in the city. And Claudette Colvin happened to stage that demonstration before Rosa Parks' incident. But she was highly influenced by Rosa Parks.
Good to know. See, that's good to know.
Because she served as the youth advisor.
That's good to know. And people sometimes put those two at loggerheads. And they shouldn't. There is a synergy between those two, Claudette Colvin and Rosa Parks. And now we see once again in our discussion the generational aspect to it.
Absolutely.
And we need to understand the intergenerational aspect. I mean, I have students now who are beginning to be a part of politics, either as interns or working within the political structure. They're starting to do social justice movements in their communities, and I look at that as part of my job as an educator, as someone who's an activist in social justice issues around law, that you don't have to go to law school. There's no, maybe there should be, but right now there's really no course on legal social justice laws. But I do want to go to voter registration in our last few moments. I want to talk about the role young people played in voter registration as we go into this 2016 cycle of the presidential election, which is going to be big. I really want young people to be inspired. And young people writ large, as I say, because I've talked to one 34-year-old who still saw himself as youth, which I really don't understand. But but we're talking about the role of young people in politics and voter registration. How did it work back then, so we can kind of inspire them to do so in the future?
So the NAACP, through the Youth Council, set up what we call citizenship workshops. And in these citizenship workshops, they would educate the community about their voting rights. And so for many African Americans living in the rural South, many were illiterate, could not read or write. In order to vote, you had to read and interpret a passage of the Constitution. And so what the NAACP did, along with other organizations like the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, through SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, set up these citizenship schools to educate black people in the South about their voting rights. And for some who could not read, they would teach them how to memorize a passage of the Constitution. So they would go into the polling station, cannot read, but they have memorized that passage of the Constitution that they would be asked, you know, to read. And it would have, you know, your more educated members to go in first, so they would know what passage of the Constitution that they would ask them to read and interpret. They would take that information back to the community and teach those people in the community what they needed to know. And through voter registration drives throughout the South, we know that JFK, John F. Kennedy's administration supported the voter education program. And you had so many young people involved in that in the South, registering blacks to vote.
So at this point, we could have young people registering people to vote. They must register themselves and their families, that they need to understand what the rights are that they're voting for, to understand mm-hmm. the political positions of the candidates, so they have a better understanding of why one particular candidate might be better for them in that position than another candidate.
Absolutely.
So these are things that they can do, especially given the fact that we talked before about mass incarceration in New York mm-hmm. State, and there are a few other states, but in New York State, one can register and vote even with a felony conviction. And so mm-hmm. it's very important for us to understand, to better realize our voting strength, that given the mass incarceration of this country, given over 2 million people who are going through our jails and prisons, that we have to reach out and find those people with felony convictions in New York State and other states where it's allowed to get those people registered. These are things young people can do, and you don't have to be a citizen to register someone else.
Absolutely. And they could start with teach-ins. We call them teach-ins, educating other, you know, people about the voting process, about their voting rights. And even though we're in the 21st century, we think that, oh, most people know about their voting rights. There are people who do not. And I think we can start to educate people around those issues, not only their rights, but we can talk about each of the political candidates. And if we start to do those kinds of teach-ins, people will be more educated around those issues.
And finally, putting the onus back on our shoulders, are we preparing our young people to be in leadership positions?
I think we need to do a better job of preparing our young people to be in leadership positions. And it starts with... you know, as I say, you know, some of the basic issues of such as having, you know, workshops around police brutality or teach-ins around police brutality. You can do it on college campuses. You can do it in the churches. You can do it in the community centers. But we can start to move out and have those kinds of educational programs.
We have been talking with a very special guest, Professor Thomas L. Bynum, the author of NAACP Youth and the Fight for Black Freedom, 1936 to 1965. I believe it's available on Amazon.
It is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders. You can also go to the University of Tennessee Press website, and the book is there too.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to your upcoming works. We want you to know that in writing about the NAACP youth movement, you have contributed very much to our discussion what role young people can play in the strategies for social change. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. We're talking about civil rights strategies then and now. Our upcoming guest is the Honorable Ambassador Andrew Young, and he will be with us in a few moments. We're very excited. This show is one in which hopefully you will be able to be inspired and you will go forward and be a part of the social change we've all been waiting for.
Had no money for to go there, babe. Keep your eyes on the prize and hold on, hold on,
hold on,
hold on,
hold on,
hold on. Keep your eyes on.
shout. Yeah. Door open and then walked out.
Right. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Journey now.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on,
hold on,
hold on,
hold on,
hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on.
Well, the only thing we did wrong was stayed in the wilderness a day too long.
A senior aide to Martin Luther King in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, a congressman, mayor, ambassador. We're talking about Andrew Young. I want you to hear this one clip before we have the Honorable Andrew Young on the line.
I was trying to think when I started in the YMCA. I was somewhere around 5 or 6 years old. Now, that's more than 75 years ago. And my mother was a secretary at an insurance company next to the Y. My daddy happened to be on the board of the Y, so I got dumped at the Y all day, every day in the summertime. It was sort of my home away from home. Things in my life. It's where I learned to get along with all kinds of people. Well, I didn't think of myself as a leader, but I saw kids leaning on me even when I was 10 and 12 years old. Jimmy Carter sent me to the United Nations. It's amazing how much the skill set of getting along with a variety of rambunctious kids. It's very similar to the United Nations. In fact, some of the kids that I had to deal with in camp were more intimidating than some of the leaders I had to deal with in countries around the world. I just find that my life has been shaped by my involvement with the YMCA. Our Y secretary, Bill Mitchell, was one of the founders, I think, of the Y in Liberia. Our Y operated like an honorary consulate for African students who were in the colleges around New Orleans. Both my brother and I ended up with a deep and abiding interest in Africa, largely because of the friendships and associations that we made at the Y and we continued in high school and in college and throughout life. As I get on in age, I find that this is the thing that keeps me going. The Y is still someplace where I come regularly. I find that I'm not only staying in good shape physically, but I run into kids who just need a word of encouragement.
And that was the Honorable Andrew Young, ambassador, congressman, mayor, who is on our program today. We're talking about civil rights strategies then and now, and the use and need to understand the role of young people in those civil rights strategies. Thank you so much for joining us, Ambassador Young.
Well, my pleasure.
And we know that you've run the gamut of so many different experiences in this country and around the world. We thank you so much for joining us. And in our discussion of civil rights strategies then and now, we're talking about the role of young people. And during your time period early on with the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, you were also young relative to how we envision the role of leaders today. Can you talk with us a little bit about what it was to be young and in those positions of leadership?
Well, we were young, but we were old, too, because in order to survive as a young person then, it was extremely dangerous just being born black. And I grew up in a neighborhood with an Irish grocery store on one corner, an Italian bar on another, and the Nazi Party headquarters on the third corner. And I had to learn to get along. I had to learn to, you know, to run, fight, or negotiate. But my father, you know, took a real effort in saying to me that you don't ever get mad, that white supremacy is a sickness. And anybody that thinks that one group of people, because of the color of their skin, is different and better than another group of people because of the color of their skin is sick. And you don't get mad with sick people. You help them. Now, I was listening to you, to that introduction, and I don't know where you got it from, but it was very good and very true. But I was celebrating this morning the kids in Missouri, who were, for the first time in my knowledge, an entire football team decided that they were not going to play football. And they weren't on their own. They had been dealing with this for over a year, and they had been thinking it through. The student government, there's a black student government president. They lived through all of the Ferguson problems, which are not far from the University of Missouri. And so that's one of the things I think is that's different, that no matter what the issue is, you have to take the time to think about it. And I think Martin Luther King and I both read Gandhi in 1950, but it was 55 before he acted on it, and it was 61 before. Well, I was down in South Georgia in 55, 56, but I didn't join up with him until 1961, and I was about 30 then, 29. So we weren't all that young, and we had, all of us had children by that time. And we had been thinking about this and studying what we were going to do. Well, Dr. King had his PhD degree. And I think the difference in our movement was that it was a serious movement that spent a whole lot of time studying and planning and understanding the nature of the enemy we were opposing. And we never thought of ourselves as victims. We thought of ourselves as being in charge of redeeming the soul of America from the triple evils of race, war, and poverty. And I'm still trying to do that. More poverty than race and war right now, because most of the things that we see as racial are really the result of poverty, and the fact that while we've made progress on race in many areas, there's still a greater percentage of poor people in America now than there were in the 60s. and the rich are getting richer, and the poor are getting poorer, and the middle class is getting left behind or squeezed out. And so we've got a very difficult situation that we just can't look at as black and white. We've got to understand the nature of the world we're in, and we've got to realize that there are no simple answers. And white folk don't know the answers, and that's one of the reasons why they're afraid of us. And sometimes they shoot first in panic and fear. I heard a figure just the other day that you know, the leading cause of death in policemen is suicide. And so you don't want to provoke people who are already sick and already on edge. And they require training. They require understanding. And as a mayor, I was able to do that. And we ended up with a police force that was about half and half black and white. But we made sure that a third of them were women, black women and white women, because women have a different approach to problems than men do.
Ambassador, when you talk about redeeming the soul of America and the three prongs, race, war, and poverty, we know that there have been laws in this program. Law of the Land discusses laws, but in the role of law, but we also want to make sure that law has a human face. And so this issue of you can legislate a certain way of life, but you can't change the heart of people.
Well, you can. And we've done that. And the people we have not changed their hearts are really mostly poor, uneducated white people that are threatened by the fact that we're moving ahead and leaving us behind. I mean, you know, Atlanta was not quite a black majority when I was first elected. It was only 38% black. So I had to find a way to reach out to everybody. And our problems were not just helping black people grow and get jobs and educated, but improving the life, the schools, and the quality of training, particularly of our police. And you can't just take a kid out of high school and give him a stick and a gun and a taser and expect him to act like he's got, you know, that he can be the authority for the law of the land. It takes a tremendous amount of training, and it takes a tremendous amount of experience. And good police forces do that. But you don't get good police forces till people start voting in good mayors who appoint wise young officers and who see to it that they get the training and the understanding that they need.
And with policing, we also see that there's this code of blue sometimes, in which it doesn't matter the race of the police officer, that once they become part of this club called a policing, then, you know, it's them versus us. And it's almost this militarization of policing where the civilian becomes the quote-unquote enemy.
Well, but that is something that we changed in Atlanta. And we made it, first place I said to the policeman, I said, look, you work for the citizens. You're not in charge of them. And we divided our community into neighborhoods, and in a precinct, every precinct had to meet with the community at least once a quarter for the community to tell the policeman how they wanted to be protected. And it's community policing, which Lee Brown, who later was mayor of Houston and who was police chief in New York, was police chief when I became mayor. And he and Maynard Jackson had already started that. But it had just started, and we kept it going and expanded it. And we're still doing that. We still require our law enforcement officers to meet with the community. Now, you saw the situation that happened in with the policeman pulling the child out of the chair.
Yes.
Well, we had policemen in our school, but they didn't wear uniforms. They wore police athletic league shirts. They were part of the recreation programs. They were part of the discipline, yes, but they didn't have guns and sticks, and they didn't bully children. They made friends with them. And the police athletic league in schools here in Atlanta was designed to prevent crime, not to bully and pick on kids.
And so we are also discussing, Ambassador Young, about the role young people can play. And we, on the one hand, you have this tension between the society and the young person, and that tension is something, as we know, is ages old, as young people try to make their way and find their way in the world, and we want them to play a role in social justice. How do we help them to find that role to play?
Well, for instance, when the sit-in started in Atlanta, the presidents of the colleges didn't say, don't demonstrate. They said, before you demonstrate, sit down together and write out what it is you're demonstrating about and what is it that you want to change. And when the students got together, it took them a couple of weeks to do that. Then the presidents put a full-page ad in the paper, and everybody knew what it was about. You cannot just have an emotional protest.
Mm-hmm.
The most effective protest that I've been involved in many places is when you just sit in silence. Like one of the guys at University of Missouri just went on a hunger fast.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he was there sitting on the campus fasting was more powerful than 50 people shouting.
And
so we have to learn that making the most noise isn't getting the question understood and isn't getting any change coming about.
And you mentioned also in your early years with the Y that that was very helpful to get along with other people. And so there's this phrase, of course, you know, that, you know, you make your friends before you need them. This sense that we need to have allies in this battle.
Exactly.
How do we best form these allies? How do they understand that there's a role for each one to play within this movement
well,
for
you
social
know,
justice?
When Dr. King was killed, we came right back to Atlanta, and there was a garbage worker strike on him. So we had to get in the garbage worker strike. We couldn't just, Dr. King had just given his life for garbage workers. And so we got in the strike, and there were a group of preachers, you know, that sort of locked arms with the garbage workers, and we were blocking the trucks from coming out. And they sent for the police, and the police came, and they jumped out of their cars, and they pulled their sticks, you know, and getting ready to beat us up. And I said, excuse me, gentlemen, I just want to let you know that these are city workers who are trying to get a three-step wage to improve their ability to take care of their families. Now, don't forget, you are city workers, too. If they get a raise, you might get one. If you beat us up and we don't get a raise, you're not going to get one either. See? And sometimes you have to, you don't assume that the policeman is right. They don't know any better sometimes. And you have to, I made a practice of, one, always looking at the police officer's name and calling him by name. So they wear badges. And I'd always dress them very respectfully, But I always try to reason with them. And it was what made our movement successful. Now, the guy, after I told him that, he still reached out, and I thought he was going to shake my hand. And he still pulled me up and put me in jail. But that was all right. Because it was done respectfully, and he had to do his job, and I had to do my job. And a couple of days later, when we set up the negotiations with the mayor and the police, I mean, the garbage workers got a raise, the police officers got a raise too, not quite as much as the garbage workers, because they were already getting paid more. But one of the things I did as mayor was raise the salaries of the police officers. Because we wanted smart officers. We wanted officers to have some college training. We sent them back to get degrees and master's degrees in criminology. Because crime is very complicated these days. And to have a bunch of kids, I mean, it was embarrassing to me to see in Ferguson with these policemen with all of this riot gear on. Mm-hmm. We had a white kid killed in an all-white neighborhood when I was mayor. And I did just what I thought, you know. I went out to see the parents, and I didn't take anybody with me but one woman police officer in plain clothes. And we went to see her, we apologized, we explained, you know, that the officer that shot her son was young and scared, and she then admitted that her son did have a knife and that he had a drug problem and he'd been in trouble before. But just by my apologizing to the parents, and trying to explain, because there's no city in the world where law enforcement is easy now. And so being against the police, we got to be on the same side, because the truth of it is, most of the black folk being killed are not killed by police.
And that issue of what's taking place within the black community with so-called black-on-black crime, we also know that within the white community, and many white people have made it appear as though they're all being killed by black people, when we know that more whites kill other whites, and the whole issue of white-on-white crime. How do we have...
It's the same.
Yes.
We don't have a race problem as much as we have a violence problem. I mean, I think it's about 93% of the blacks who are killed by other blacks, and I think it's 86% of the whites who are killed by other whites. And 53% of the guns fired in the home, 53% of the accidents in the home come from people within the same family who have guns. So there's a violence problem that we haven't addressed, and we have to take our time. We have to think this through, but it all goes back to, if everybody had a job. See, now the problem in Ferguson, I thought, was not just Ferguson, but it was that Budweiser was moving out of St. Louis. And St. Louis is having serious economic problems. The problems we're having in Detroit. When I became mayor of Atlanta, there were 6 million people in Detroit and 1 million people in Atlanta. Now there are 1 million people in Detroit and 6.5 million people in Atlanta.
Wow.
But it's not race. It's governance. And it's thinking through the complicated problems of the world in which we live. Now, fortunately, I had a really good, tough lawyer preceding me as mayor, Maynard Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And Maynard understood, one, he understood the law, but more important, he understood money. And so when we built our airport, we wouldn't build it unless 25% of every contract was done by somebody, minority-owned company. Not just the dirt digging, but the bonds and insurance and the design and the engineering, every single part of that airport, you know, black people participated in. When I became mayor, I raised it to 35%. And when we won the Olympics, we increased it to 40%. And our airport now earns $38 billion a year, and it creates 400,000 jobs. And at least half of all of that is black.
And so...
And that's got nothing to do... I mean, when I first talked to the... When I first talked to the Chamber of Commerce about being mayor, they said, well, what are you going to do? You Democrats always raise taxes. I said, you can't raise taxes when nobody's got any money. And he said, well, what are you going to... How are you going to run the city? I said, I'm going to run the city by making Atlanta the next great international city. And one of my banker friends said, where in the hell did that nut come from? And it never occurred to him. But we brought in business from all over the world into Atlanta. I went to Germany and brought Lufthansa Airlines, and we brought the airlines from Switzerland and Holland and Japan. All of those were places where people were, had money. And when they started flying into Atlanta, they realized that this was a good place to invest. And I would meet with everybody that wanted to invest. If you were coming to Atlanta to invest money or to start a business, you didn't need an appointment with the mayor. You just walk into the office, and I would stop what I was doing. And I would, you know, it didn't take but 5 or 10 minutes, and I could get back to whatever else it was. But we put investors first, and I gave them my home number, and I gave them, we didn't have cell phones back then, but I gave them my direct line to my desk, and I said, look, if you have any problems, let me solve them. Don't complain about it.
Well, I'm hoping that our Mayor de Blasio is listening, or some member of his staff is listening to our program today, because I also want to go back to the spiritual part of this
yeah.
vision. Because in discussing the civil rights movement and strategies then and now, there was a spiritual part of social justice. And as a minister and a member of SCLC and working with Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, what spiritual component do you see that was there in the strategy for social justice that may be missing now?
Well, it was either spirituality or insanity. Because, I mean, we had, people don't realize that Martin Luther King never had $1 million a year to work with. And we had maybe 50 people on a staff at our largest, and then we had, everybody else was volunteer. And he used to say, you have to be certifiably insane to try to do what we're doing. He said, or you have to really have faith in God. And so it was faith in God, because we weren't fully crazy. But it was, you know, it was kind of crazy to think that we could change Birmingham. That was the meanest city in the South. In the 60s, 61 and 62, there were over 60 bombings of people's homes just for nothing. Fred Shuttlesworth's church was bombed 3 times in 1 year. And nobody was ever arrested, and nobody, they didn't even investigate it. So we went over there, and, but we suddenly realized it was segregated because we were cooperating with segregation. So when we said to the black community, look, all we have to do is keep our money in our pockets. And for 90 days, nobody black and quite a few whites didn't spend anything, didn't buy anything but food and medicine. No clothes, no cars, no nothing. No Christmas presents, no Easter presents. And when we shut down the economy, all of a sudden people were willing to sit down and let's see what we can do to change this so we can get your business back. And that was, I mean, everybody talks about the dogs and the fire hoses, but what really changed Birmingham was that we decided we were not going to finance segregation. And if they were going to put up black and white signs, we weren't going in there. And if they were not going to hire black people in important jobs, we weren't going to shop there. And once they understood that, it changed in fact, Birmingham changed almost 2 years before the federal government changed. Everything the Birmingham business community agreed with us on in 1963 was against the law in Alabama, and George Wallace didn't say a word. And it wasn't until 1964 in July that the law changed. But we changed it in May of 1963. When 100 businessmen got together and signed an agreement with Martin Luther King and Reverend Shuttlesworth.
That is so amazing. I'm looking at my engineer right now. We're both saying that's a part of the movement, the history of it, that's rarely discussed.
Well, because I wrote it in my book, but you know, they only did one publication of my book. And none of us who wrote about what was really happening, I'm still trying to tell our story. We have a film company that called Andrew Young Presents, and we make about 4 films a year trying to tell the story of what really happened. Because even the distinguished white historians who made a whole lot of money telling what went on were not in the room. And they didn't know what was really going on. They were writing from their research, and it's mostly accurate, but they got influenced by the FBI files and things like that, which was really mostly untrue and exaggeration. I mean, not that we were saints, but we certainly weren't, you know, wild men crazy.
And so the in our last moments together, I wanted to ask you this question about, in experiencing those unfair situations, the discrimination, the racism, being jailed so many times.
Well, I was just jailed twice.
I
got beat up a couple of times. And but I didn't, jail was okay. Jail was safe for me because I ended up not being able to go to jail. I had to stay out in the streets and kind of keep things going. I always, you know, they always kidded me about not going to jail. I said, it's safer in jail than it is out here catching hell.
Well, I wanted, being beaten, these young people, as you expressed at University of Missouri, which is my alma mater, actually. And
well, you can be proud of them.
Well, I am very proud of them. The experiences that you go through, and they've said that it's more difficult to keep these feelings inside and deal with racism than to actually use that as energy to do something about social injustice.
When growing up, I was born in 1932. See, it was rough in LaSalle then. And being in a predominantly white neighborhood with very few children, and they were all poor. My daddy started training me when I was 4 years old about how, I mean, you had to fight. You couldn't let people pick on you. But mostly you had to think. And he said, you never lose your temper in a fight. If you lose your temper in a fight and get emotional, you lose the fight. And he used to say, don't get mad, get smart. He said, when you lose your temper, you're going to lose your head. And even as a kid, he would box with me. And if I started swinging wild, he smacked me upside my head and said, see, you lose your temper, you lose your head.
And you are the author of A Way Out of No Way, the spiritual memoirs of Andrew Young.
And the other one, the bigger burden on the civil rights movement, is called An Easy Burden. And it came from the Bible verse, take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And I always felt that we were successful because we were being led where the Lord wanted us to go. And it always worked out, never as we planned it. If we were faithful and if we were concerned about the needs, you know, and kind of organized the people, but again, everybody says everybody was together then. That's not true. There were over 400 black churches in Birmingham, and only 14 of them would even let us have a meeting. See, so when Martin Luther King went to jail to write the letter from the Birmingham jail, there were only 4 preachers with him, and only 54 people went to jail. It wasn't a big crowd. Now, everybody took part in a boycott because it was easy not to spend your money. And if you got caught going downtown spending your money, folks talked about you.
We are having a wonderful conversation that, unfortunately...
Now, you said you're from Missouri.
I am from Kansas City.
Where's the station?
This station is in New York City. I was born and raised in the Midwest, and I've been living in New York for several decades now. And I was, in college at University of Missouri, Columbia, where those young people are fighting a good battle.
They really, I think that's the best of the movements recently, because they were thoughtful, they were spiritual, and, you know, we took the time, the way we got students to go to jail, we organized the football team, the cheerleaders, the student government leaders on the campuses, and we sent them to jail on a Friday and promised to get them out on a Sunday so they could go back to school and say they had a good experience in jail. And, you know, some of us went with them. And jail became a prayer meeting, and more young people decided to change their lives going to jail than they did in revivals. But they came back and they went to their schools and they talked about what they learned in jail, and pretty much we organized I think over 5,000 students went to jail on one day in Birmingham. And that literally shut the whole town down.
This is civil rights, then and now, a riveting discussion with our elder, the wise, the wonderful, the minister, the congressman, the mayor, the ambassador, Andrew Young. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. It is appreciated by me and by all of our listeners. This is a show for history. Thank you, Dr.
Okay, Young. And if you see my buddy Dave Dinkins or Charlie Rangel, Dave was the one who helped me through college at Howard University. He was just coming back from the Marines, And I was a crazy young kid coming up from New Orleans. So he helped make a man out of me. So I always consider him my big brother. So tell him hello for me.
I will do that, sir. Thank you.
And Charlie Rangel looked out for me in the Congress.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. All right. God bless you.
Bless you.
Hands
bye-bye.
To the heavens. No man, no weapon. Formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day.
Erica King Toler, PhD, professor in the Sikh Department of John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She teaches courses in social justice and education, and she is joining us now after such a riveting conversation with the ambassador, Andrew Young, discussing civil rights strategies then and now, and with Erica King Toler. Dr. King Toler is going to talk to us about how do we process all of this? What do we do in the face of seeing what has happened in the past, what's going on now? We want to take a part in it. We want to not be subjected to it. What do we do with all that emotion and the strategy to go forward in social justice? There's a human price. And that human toll needs to be reconciled as well. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. King Toler.
Good morning to you, Gloria. It's good to be here with you and to join your listening audience today.
And you have such wonderful area of expertise that is in great need as always, but now, especially as the community is wrestling with having seen such injustice over the last 2.5 years, feeling the trauma of watching the Eric Garner video again and again and again of having this grown black man wrestled to the ground and strangled. We see the shots fired at Walter Scott in South Carolina and these other incidents in Ohio. We want to do something as a community, and we come to you, a psychologist, thinking with the sensitivity of the black community, having heard the conversation we just had, if you had a chance to listen to any of it, mm-hmm. with Ambassador Young, what do we do with all this emotion? What do we do with these feelings?
Well, first of all, Gloria, I'd like to give just a little bit of language so that we are all in the same place in understanding. So one of the things that we know about these incidents is it is very traumatic. And trauma is an emotional, it's a normal response to seeing things like an accident, being a victim of violent crime, or even being a Katrina survivor, you know, surviving a natural disaster. To expand that definition of trauma a little bit more, we also, the American Psychiatric Association, has begun talks about using the term racism as a form of trauma. As a matter of fact, there was a national study done by the American Life, and they found that Americans, African Americans in particular, show a prevalence rate of 9.1% for post-traumatic stress symptoms, versus 6.8% in our non-white Hispanic populations. So that right there shows that we are being affected by these things that we're seeing at a disparate proportion. So one of the things that we also talk a lot about is the notion of vicarious traumatization. And that's the emotional residue of being exposed to hearing people's traumatic stories and becoming witness to their pain, their fear, and the terror that racial trauma survivors have endured. So when you began to talk about seeing the images of the very public images of Eric Garner, the very public images of Trayvon Martin, we begin to see these things over and over again. And also, the notion of microaggressions are a big part of our lives as well. Any African American who's ever gone into a store and been followed has experienced microaggressions.
And I'm of the mind that after a shooting, a police shooting in particular, there is this intense increase in microaggressions. This is my anecdotal experience as someone who has watched behavior after a police shooting, which is different from a civilian upon a civilian crime because that police officer represents the government. I want to go back to something that is part of this show because we're trying to discern the role of young people as part of the civil rights strategy, what that strategy was in the past and how young people played a role. And now, could it be that these microaggressions, could it be that these views are in some ways making young people feel that they're afraid of participating in social justice because they have been traumatized by things in their own community and the dogs in the films and all that might happen to them if they get involved in social justice?
Absolutely. And what we also know about trauma is it just doesn't happen in one generation. It is multi-generational. And there is another psychologist, Dr. Joy DeGruy, who has a term that she uses called post-traumatic slave syndrome. And what that means is it examines the consequences of oppression over time. And what happens to a generation when that oppression continues and it doesn't seem like it's ever going to lift. So in some of our younger populations and even some of the elders, we see, you know, sometimes feelings of hopelessness, depression, and a general self-destructive outlook. So you, in the previous segment, you all talked about black-on-black violence and black-on-black crime being a problem in our community. We also have, as it relates to post-traumatic slave syndrome, extreme feelings of suspicion or about people's motives. Here I'm trying to be your friend, but perhaps you're not so sure about that friendship that we're trying to build and to build alliances so that we can fight back or participate in protests. There's also a sense of learned helplessness that we're seeing, and, you know, distorted self-concepts and just being apathetic, not really wanting to join, not really wanting to be a part. So absolutely. One of the other things that you all talked about that I wanted to make a connection to in the previous segment was Ambassador Young talked about the fact that his father was willing to speak with him and to tell him what was going on and how he needed to confront the discrimination that he might encounter. And these are the types of things that we need to be doing with our next generation. If we're aware that this multi-generational oppression is happening, we need to inform our children. We need to let them know how they can participate, what they can do to make a change.
And with Ambassador Young, one of the things we need to understand is he talked about the fact that he grew up with, you know, a community where he had to fight.
Right.
And so we have young people today who are in communities in which sometimes they have to fight. And it's a kind of a this conflict can rise up because it's like, oh, just say no, just walk away. But what if you can't walk away? What if you are forced into a situation in which you have to be in a role in which you don't want to play? And that is the role of, you know, self-defense. I've got to fight my way out of this. And we're not really giving our children the tools to navigate a violent world. And that's the other thing that Congressman and Honorable Young talked about was the fact that we're dealing with violence in a community, and yet we want to pretend like this violence doesn't exist. So we're not equipping our young people with the tools they need to deal with violence.
Well, I think that the example that we can look at is the past rioting that went on in Baltimore. And just the boiling point that we saw the young people, they had had enough. And when we look at post-traumatic slave syndrome, that teaches us that that is a normal response to feeling oppressed and never having an opportunity to, you know, voice or feel like people are hearing you. We see it in our educational system where for minor infractions, children are being jailed. We see the pictures on Facebook about the young girl who had the phone. And how should you respond? How should young people respond if they see something like that? If we have not trained them, what are your rights? And knowing how to speak up and be able to, you know, fight back, then we see the where it reaches a boiling point where there is a great deal of anger, and that is a very normal response to feeling so oppressed and, you know, microaggressions that we might see.
And there was a time, as Andrew Young pointed out, in which it was in your face. The laws were written in a racially discriminatory way. You knew where you could and could not go. Now that things are underground in many ways, I think young people are wrestling with a type of racism that doesn't have an overt part to it. So it's almost psychological, which makes what you do even more important. So this psychological warfare and this warfare of propaganda, of depicting people of color certain ways and then not having, as you said, a voice or a platform to combat that and having to act out, or maybe many of them feel the need to act out. We're both people who deal with young people in our jobs, and to see that there's this struggle that they're in right now where many of them would like to participate in social justice. Uh-huh. And it's been said that if one does participate in some type of activity that allows them to feel a sense of control, to work on a better future, uh-huh, that is better than sitting back and feeling like there's a victim. Is that true?
I agree. There have been many discussions in my course and teaching students how to organize themselves, how to, at this impressionable age, at 18, 19, 20 years old, these are the people who are going to be on the forefront for us. And I think it's important as educators that we let them know what the history is, what the historic struggles have been, but also to help prepare them. Again, having these conversations is so important, and in many homes, these conversations are not happening. One of the things that I think a lot about is that what we need to do, and this may be heresy, but we need to turn off the TV and the computer to eliminate exposure to this nonstop barrage of negative images that we see that are creating anxiety. Being able to create a space that is news-free. Many homes and many families have the TV going 24/7, even when they're sleeping. And as a psychologist, when I encounter people who have sleep disorders, I talk to them about what is your sleep hygiene, right? So eliminating those images so that the psyche can be free and not bombarded with anxiety and negativity. That's one of the things that I think, and I talk to my students a lot about this. So even clearing that psyche out. Also, allowing spaces where students and also, you know, elders can come together to do some intergenerational work. And as a psychologist, I'm always going to advocate for psychotherapy. And that means talking to someone that allows you to process how you're feeling and not saying, stop complaining. Because a lot of times we hear from the media that these are just complaints. These are empty complaints that have no merit. And I think we need to continue to talk about it. We need to bring it to the forefront and to know that there is healing, there is restorative power in speaking, the spoken word. One of the things that I also see in young people that now are, you know, facing some of these issues is they use the written word, such as keeping journals to document their feelings and thoughts. using creative endeavors such as writing songs and poems and plays as an outlet to experience, to express that pain that they're feeling when they see, you know, people in their generation being shot down or choked or just maligned in some way. Using those types of endeavors to give voice to how they're feeling.
And we're talking with Dr. Erica King-Toler, a psychologist, a former member, executive officer of the Association of Black Psychologists. She is discussing how young people can deal with these issues of injustice and find their way through them in a healthy manner so that they can be a part of the change they want to see. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you on in the future to further discuss these issues, because we think it's very important to understand how the emotional impact of injustice can affect an individual as well. Thank you, Dr. King-Toler.
Thank you, Gloria.
And as we finish our show, this completion of a program that has been filled with so much information on WBAI Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, you heard from amazing guests, starting with Thomas L. Bynum, a professor of African American history, and he was teaching us about the role of young people in this program dedicated to civil rights strategies using the power of the young people then and now. He was a professor discussing his book, NAACP Youth and the Fight for Black Freedom, 1936 to 1965, a professor at Middle Tennessee State University. We were also, of course, overwhelmed by the knowledge of our elder, the wise and wonderful Congressman, Mayor, Ambassador of an Atlanta, just amazing icon, Andrew Young, the minister who told us about the spiritual, historical, and the basis of his and Martin Luther King's strategies around civil rights and social justice. And we ended with our psychologist, Erica King-Toler of John Jay College. This has been Gloria J. Brown Marshall with Law of the Land, my engineer, Michael G. Haskins, and, of course, you, our WBAI audience. I'll see you on the radio.
The following is a statement from a WBAI local station board candidate. The views expressed are not those of WBAI management, staff, or current board. To view full candidate statements, visit www.elections.pacifica.org.
Hi, I'm James Sagerton, running for the local station board. As a WBAI volunteer and member of both the Finance Committee and the Community Advisory Board, I've seen firsthand what's up. Membership and donations are down. We're not reaching young people on the internet. We've lost millions in grants because one faction-run sister station hasn't completed required audits for years. Now, a new leasing agent for the Empire State Building seems unwilling to finish renegotiating our high antenna rent. So proposals to sell, swap, or lease our signal are flying around without any transparency for the listeners. I'll work with anyone to save WBAI, but the candidates I've seen doing the most to fix it are with the Elect Indy Caucus 2015. Vote James Sagerton. Vote Indy.
Warm greetings to BAI members. Mi más cordiales saludos a todos. I'm Dacio Quintana, running for the board with the Justice and Unity Campaign, endorsed by Pro Libertad and others, because we must strengthen this precious resource. I'm a retired teacher who's organized for years around social justice issues. I volunteer with the group Strategies for Social Change. At BAI, I've witnessed mismanagement and nastiness that have weakened the station. We need to implement a diversified fundraising plan using detailed proposals by Justice and Unity and others. We need more programming that conveys the activism of youth and our diverse communities. Please vote for the entire Justice and Unity slate. Visit justiceunity.org.
Stop members of the Pacifica National Board from selling WBAI. Pacifica and WBAI have lost more than $2 million because of the same board member's appointment of a CFO who failed to submit an audit. My name is Alex Steinberg. Years ago, I was a highly effective member of the Pacifica National Board. I know where the bodies are buried. I am running again so we could save WBAI and the Pacifica Network. Only the Indy Elect Caucus 2015 candidates are pledged to change the National Board and management and save WBAI. If you want accountability, financial stability, progressive programming, and an end to cronyism, vote for me, Alex Steinberg. For more information, go to electindycaucus2015.org.
Hello, WBAI. My name is Bob Young, and I am an independent caucus member running for re-election as a listener candidate on the local station board. For the past 3 years, I have served the listeners faithfully as chair and as vice chair with an almost perfect attendance record. The LSB is only empowered to certain tasks by the bylaws. I pledge to support them and not make false promises about what can and cannot be done. I support transparency and accountability in Pacifica and in WBAI. Please vote for me, Bob Young, and the whole Elect Indy Caucus 2015 team. Visit us at www.electindycaucus2015.org and at our Facebook page by the same name. Thank you.
The views expressed are not those of WBAI management, staff, or current board. To view full candidate statements, visit www.elections.pacifica.org.